The Fearless Podcast, in a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act.
Hey, Sean Baker, welcome back to the Fearless Podcast. How you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good. Just real good. Like I said, I had me a nice ribeye steak and got some sprinting, jumping, and lifting in, so I'm feeling good, man.
Awesome, man. I caught you just at the right time. Well, just as an intro, for listeners who may not be familiar with your work, can you briefly explain your journey and how you became a leading advocate, dare I say, the author of the book, Carnivore Diet?
Yeah, well, I mean, I certainly wrote the book. Yeah, I mean, advocate, I mean, basically, I'm an orthopedic surgeon by training, spent years operating on people, putting their new hips, new knees, new shoulders, fixing broken bones, doing sports type surgeries. When I was in my kind of, I don't know, early mid 40s, I started realizing my health wasn't where I wanted it to be. Started messing around with nutrition, you know, worked my way through those various nutritional schemes, ended up low carb for a while, ran into these crazy wacko people eating just nothing but meat, thought they were totally nuts. But I was curious enough to try it myself. And when I tried it, I was really just really kind of a little bit blown away on how good I actually felt with it. And so I kind of stuck with it. You know, was convinced some other people to do it. We started seeing, you know, this is back in 2016, I think. We started seeing more and more people having good results. Eventually, I got picked up on Rogan's podcast to talk about this. And yeah, Rogan thought I was nutty like everybody else did, you know, at the time. And but after that, you know, I was asked to write a book about this. I wrote the book, The Carnivore Diet. And, you know, since that time, we've had, gosh, I mean, it must be more than a million people have done it now. I mean, it's gotten so crazy where everybody's trying. And so, you know, we just see a lot of good results on, you know, I mean, just a lot of things get better. I mean, it's, you know, I don't want to call it a panacea or anything like that, but I mean, it's effective for a lot of things. And so I've been an advocate. I founded a company called Rivero, which is a digital health company. You know, I've been frustrated with the healthcare system for quite a while. You know, I went in with the right intentions and you know, you get busy and you're just hammered trying to do the right thing, work. You kind of grind as a physician. I mean, you're running all day long. You don't have time to think more or less, you know, kind of pontificate about the direction of medicine. But, I got exposed to what I thought was a real problem with the medical system. And this has been my effort to try to make it right in a way and change the way we do healthcare. And so we can talk about that later if you want. But that's kind of me in a nutshell. I'm very polarizing. You know, there's people that like me. There's people that can't, you know, think I'm an idiot, you know. But, I mean, it's the way it is, you know. I mean, you get out there, you put your message, you know, you get in an arena and there's going to be people that, you know, cheer and boo. So that's me.
Well, yeah, and that's why I love your approach, because in order to kind of break through the malaise or the propaganda, you know, we have to use satire and wit, you know, and
but you meme everybody to death, right? That's the thing today. You put memes in meme everybody.
And that's become illegal on certain platforms, but anyway, we still try our best. But
yeah, I mean, if you're like today, Canada or the UK, man, they'll freaking throw you in jail for making a joke. I mean, it's like freaking ridiculous.
Yeah, it's coming. But I thought today maybe we could talk about these tsunamis. I keep running into more and more people, and I have family members incredibly close to me, dare I say genetically, that are on these GLP-1s. I just see it as this epidemic, the way they're being prescribed, the cost, the impact. So I thought maybe we could discuss, could you maybe break down what a GLP-1 is and how these meds, like say Ozempic or Wegovy, like what they're supposedly doing for your metabolic system?
Yeah, so if we define what GLP-1 is, GLP-1 stands for glucagon-like peptide. It is a hormone that's secreted by our gut. It's GLP-1. There's a GLP-2, which has some other effects that aren't really as special with it, regard to this. But so they have medicines that mimic, they're not the exact drug, but they stimulate the same hormone. So they're called GLP-1 receptor agonists. So the hormone interacts with a receptor and then it causes its action. Well, the drugs just bypass everything and go straight to the receptor. And it's produced in the gut, usually kind of lower down in the gut, kind of in something called the ileum, which is a third part of the small intestine, by these cells called L cells. And what they kind of do is, there's nutrient sensors in our gut. It kind of tells us where nutrients are, what's getting down there. And when nutrition gets too far along into our gut says, wait a minute, slow things down. It's like, ho, stuff's coming in too fast. Let's turn the pipe down a little bit. Slow the water down. So that's what a GLP-1 does in the body, right? It's, you know, and it's got a number of effects, but that's kind of what it does. And so It has some actions on the brain, has some actions on the pancreas, you know, so on and so forth. So these drugs, in the, I should clear, in the body, that hormone will last, you know, a couple minutes. The body will say, hey, there's too much protein's getting down there, slow things down. It slows things down. The signal goes away after about 5 minutes. And then, you know, because stomach react. The drugs hang around for sometimes weeks. You got to slow the gut down for weeks. So if you get surgery and you're on one of these drugs, guess what? They're saying we're canceling surgery until you've been off the drug at least a month, right? Because what happens is if your gut is really slow, food is sitting in your stomach. And if you've ever had surgery, what do they tell you to do? Don't eat. Before he goes, you know, don't eat NPO after midnight, nothing paras after midnight. And the reason for that is they don't want anything in your stomach, because if it stays in your stomach, when you go under anesthesia, it can come up into your lungs. You can aspirate, you can get sick and die, you get pneumonia, sick and die from that. So we're seeing the same thing with the drugs. It just keeps food in your stomach for a lot longer. Some people get gastroparesis where it just gets stuck and their gut slows down, kind of maybe permanently for some people. So there's side effects. Certainly it's causing weight loss in a lot of people. I mean, the data out there, 1 year, 2 year, I think they've got 3 year data on some of these, shows that, you know, you can have consistent long-term weight loss as long as you stay on the drugs, right? $1,000 a month, you know, blah, blah, blah. And what, you know, basically stay on it for the rest of your life. And so it's a really good business model. It's a great business model because so many people are obese. So you could potentially, you know, give this drug to 50% of the population, that's 150 million Americans, at $1,000 a month for the rest of their life. Yeah, you can finance a few yachts and homes on the Amalfi Coast of Italy and blah 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 with that scenario. So it's a business model. Now the downside is obviously there's a potential for a lot of side effects. There is certainly the potential for significant muscle loss. You know, you don't want to lose a bunch of lean mass when you're doing that. So we know that. So there are things you can do to combat that. Eat a lot of protein, workout. But again, if people are doing that anyway, they probably wouldn't need to be on the drugs as much. I mean, this is kind of the catch-22 situation here. The other thing is that in some of the drugs, like I think with semaglutide, the drug actually causes you to grow new fat cells. So they're smaller, they're tiny little fat cells, and they're very, very, you know, metabolically sort of affected by the drug so that they don't gain fat. However, when you go off the drug, now you got more fat cells and you're hungry as hell. So what happens is you're just going to blow back up. Most people do when they go off it. And, you know, a lot of people, I mean, I talk to ER physicians and, man, a lot of them are saying, man, we're getting all these people in there with really bad intractable nausea, vomiting, gut ups, you know, bowel obstructions, gastroparesis. There's some evidence that it increases your risk for suicide. Some evidence there's a rare instance where it doubles your risk for a certain type of blindness. So, I mean, it's not without its significant complications, significant cost. Many people will do it without these things, but I mean, you're kind of rolling the dice a little bit there. So it's kind of like, well, you know, maybe I get this bad side effect, maybe I don't. Is there a better way? I think there is. I think there certainly is. But, you know, I guess some of the concerns are, well, you know, maybe the American taxpayer should pay for all the people that are obese to take these drugs. This is preferable to, like, let's fix the frigging food supply, you know, because that's too hard. That's gonna piss off too many people. That's gonna be too much. People are making a lot of money, not making so much money. And so we'd rather just give drug companies more money to deal with this problem. So anyway, I think, like I said, I think there's gonna be a few people that probably, all things being considered, it's a risk reward thing. If you gotta lose 50 pounds or 20 pounds or 30 pounds, in my view, ain't worth it. You know, if you're like 600 pounds, then then there might be an argument made for that. But you know, everybody's going to have their own opinion on this.
Yeah, and what I'm hearing more and more is this is becoming boilerplate, like if you're diabetic. So one of my really good friends, and he's actually a listener, his dad was diabetic, and his doc immediately put him on one of these GLP-1s. I think it was Ozempic. And he said his dad was visiting, and he said his dad looked like straight up like a zombie, like a meat jacket tied on a skeleton. Like, he just lost all his muscle mass. He lost all the weight, but, you know, his face and everything was sunken in, and he just certainly didn't look healthy, you know? And what I keep reading is, like, this is a new protocol for diabetes, because they say, obviously, if you're overweight, you know, it's going to exacerbate your comorbidities and your diabetes. So you need to lose weight. So take the shot, you know? And,
yeah, I mean, they're going to use it. I mean, there's going to be all kinds of indications. It's going to be straight. I mean, it was originally a diabetes drug. I mean, this is where they've got 15 years data on diabetes. And, you know, it certainly hasn't put diabetes out of, I mean, there's still this as many diabetics. In fact, there's more diabetics. In fact, every time we have, the more drugs we have for chronic disease, the more chronic disease there is. Because none of these drugs ever are never curative. They're just symptom management. So if obesity is a disease and the symptom is too much body fat, then this is treating these symptoms, right? And so all we're doing is pharmaceutical symptom whack-a-mole. I mean, this is what healthcare has devolved into. Oh, I've got a symptom, whack it with a drug. Here's another symptom, whack it with another drug. And you keep doing that until these people and everybody's medicated. You know, it's a very profitable model for sure. But is it getting at the root cause of what's driving it? You know, it's like taking a bunch of antidotes. I'm going to keep poisoning myself, but I'm just going to give myself antidote. Just stop taking the poison, right? The reason, and it has all these sort of off-label effects that are generally considered positive, you know, less blood pressure, better diabetes control, so on and so forth. Maybe they're seeing people with less cravings for alcohol. And it's because you're removing, and I don't think it's a drug effect. I think it's the absence of the garbage food that you're putting in your mouth. So you could say, well, if I just stop putting the garbage food in my mouth, I'd get all these great benefits without having to pay the money and lose all my muscle mass and be subject to all these side effects. So because I see a lot of the claims that are being made, it's kind of funny because I see these physicians and they're like, oh, I have a patient on Ozempic and he was able to quit smoking because he didn't feel like it. And, you know, and I'll say, you know, I got people on a carnivore diet. They say they don't feel like smoking. Oh, that's just anecdotal. You know, they'll tell me that, but at the same time, if it's Ozempic, oh, they have wild license to make all these statements that they want, and they don't need a randomized control trying to make those statements. But when I sit there and say, look, I got 500 people that put their diabetes in remission, oh, it's just anecdote, right? But anyway, it's funny to see when these guys turn around and do the same thing they've been complaining about.
Well, I have a family member on Ozempic, and she said, well, the reason I don't eat is I feel so sick to my stomach.
Right.
I just can't eat. And I'm like, well, wow, that's, I mean, just a little bit of discipline and self-control. And if you would fast and whatnot, like you could achieve the same results without all the hormonal disruption. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that as far as like ghrelin and leptin and what this does to your hormones and how it completely disrupts that and how there could be potential long-term issues with
Well, you know, again, anytime you dump an exogenous hormone into the body, I don't care if it's testosterone, I don't care if it's, you know what happens to guys when they take steroids? Their nuts shrink up and they stop producing their own testosterone. So anytime you dump an exogenous in there, your own internal capacity is downregulated. I mean, that's going to go for, I don't care what the hormone is. This is the way the feedback loops work in the body. Certainly are, and again, GLP-1 functions normally in a normal cycle in the body in response to appropriate physiologic inputs. I eat the right food. It goes in my gut. It says, hey, slow things down. But when you have this constant on switch, it's supposed to be an on-off switch with a dimmer. You just got it cranked up to 10 all the time. That's going to have implications across the board in the body. And a lot of those we don't know yet. We won't find out for 10 years. I mean, this is the thing. You know, and here's the thing. So when we have a new drug that comes onto the market, right, the FDA approves it. They give them the kind of rubber stamp. This is safe and effective. We're going to put it in the population. They do it under unlimited data. They don't have like 20-year data. They just, okay, we got 3 years of data. We got some rat studies. We got a few human trials. And the drug companies conduct them themselves. They provide all the data. They're somewhat semi-transparent with their data. A lot of times they don't show all their data. So it gets approved conditionally, pending, and they're supposed to do this post-market surveillance, right? So we're supposed to look, are there any signals? Well, there's a program called MedWatch. It's run by the FDA. But apparently less than 1% of all like post-market drug complications, serious complications are ever even reported. Most physicians don't even know about it. So you've got all these physicians saying, literally telling us, hey, look, this is my 15th person this week that came in with intractable nausea and vomiting in the ER because he's on a GLP-1. Has any of that been reported to the FDA? No. No one reports that stuff. So it takes 10 years to figure this stuff out. If it were mandatory, say, look, any person that's on this drug or any new drug, if they come into the emergency room with a serious adverse event, it's mandatory required to be reported. It's not. I thought it would be, but it's not. I didn't know that. So anyway, we've got all these issues that are going to show up. And we'll find out, like I said, in 10 years. But guess what? 10 years from now, they'll have another drug.
Right.
They'll just go to the night. This is what they've been doing forever.
Well, yeah. And then you'll have 10 years of additional side effects of like jacking with everybody's hormones. And then there'll be all new side effects for all these poor people. What's kind of very interesting with this particular drug and the excessive cost of it, Tucker Carlson recently had this Brigham Bueller on, and he was explaining how these pharmacy benefit managers increase the cost and how these GLP-1s could be 30 to 40% cheaper. But thanks to these pharmaceutical benefits managers, they're artificially inflating the cost, which is also messing with the diabetics, insulin, and all this other stuff. Regarding metabolic health and a carnivore diet, one of the biggest resistances to it is that is expensive. But if you think about it from a sense of total cost, and if folks are paying $1,000 a month to get their GLP-1 subscription, then how much more could they? You can buy a lot of meat for $1,000 a month.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is a carnivore diet is not more expensive than a regular diet. As long as you're willing to eat things like ground beef, and there's nothing wrong with that. I take a lot of pictures of steak because it looks better. But I mean, I eat a lot of ground beef, and you can roll into the grocery. Because you guys are in Texas somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Yes, you go into like HEB or Kroger or something like that. You can find ground beef for $3-4 a pound all the time. Pound and a half of beef a day. You spend $5-6 a day. I mean, that's cheaper than a damn Starbucks drink. So it's not. It's not more expensive. And you're absolutely right. It's far less expensive than taking a GLP-1. Now, a lot of people say, well, my insurance covers it. Well, guess what? Who's paying for your insurance? Who's paying that? We're all paying for our medical premium. That's why everybody's paying $700, $800, $1,000, $2,000 a month for their family medical insurance, because all these stupid drugs cost so friggin' much. And it's crazy times for sure.
Yeah, I just had Andy Scuvener on from Crowd Health.
Andy and Bergen. Yeah. I know both those guys. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, so, maybe we could, I know you brought up Rivero and what you're doing over there, and maybe we could talk about what you're doing over there that would kind of fit this need as far as metabolic health, how to address these different metabolic issues like diabetes, like obesity, and how Rivero can help improve that and work
absolutely.
With these
people. Yeah, so Rivero, it's R-E-V-E-R-O, or Rivero.com. We're a digital healthcare company. We are in, I think right now we're in about 22 states. We'll be at all 50 by the end of March. And so we've got, tons of patients, lots of providers, and they're all like aligned with nutrition, lifestyle is a way. They deprescribe drugs more so than they prescribe. They tend to basically get people off Medicaid because we're like, we can fix this. We don't need to be on that. We attack the root cause of the issues. But one of the things that I will maintain is that, if you're suffering from a chronic disease, diabetes, Crohn's disease, psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, whatever it might be, obesity, hypertension, there is a dietary component to that, and it's significant. And if you don't address that, and a lot of times you're quite honestly dealing with addiction. A lot of people have addiction to processed food that can't get off this stuff. It's designed literally to be addictive. I mean, it's like people are, I remember who was it was saying, Kevin Hall said, we need a study to study what's going on in the food that's making everybody addicted. I said, just ask the food companies. They know. They did it intentionally. Just get somebody who used to work for them and say, because this is what we put in the food and now everybody's addicted to it. It's not a mystery in my view. But when you're dealing with that, when you're treating chronic disease, you better be addressing nutrition. You better be addressing the lifestyle. If you don't do that, you're going to fail. You can't just medicate it. You can't keep playing this, like I said, symptom whack-a-mole with drugs. But when you're addressing someone's eating behaviors and addictions and psychology, it takes time. It takes effort. It's not a 15-minute visit once every 3 months like you normally go to the doctor. So our physicians oversee everything. We have an entire care team that we'll literally interact with people on a daily basis if necessary. So when you sign up for Rivera, you get a whole team and you'll get daily feedback, daily interactions. And so what happens is you don't got to wait 3 months to stop your hypertension meds if you don't need it. We'll look at it. Well, your blood pressure is normalized within a week. Get rid of that drug. So we have, or if you're not doing well, we'll intervene and say, hey, man, seems like things aren't going right for you. Let's see what else we can do. So it's a very hands-on, intensive, high patient contact type of model that we utilize, because I think that's what it takes. Like when I was practicing as an orthopedic surgeon, I mean, I'd have 50 patients to see a day. I mean, and this is typical of most orthopedic offices. You know, you got a 15-minute visit and they double book you. I got two patients to see in 15 minutes and you're running all day long. You can't have a good discussion about lifestyle. You barely got time to see, you know, ask them about their shoulder and, you know, do the billing and coding. So this is a way to slow things down, to provide actual healthcare, to get to the root cause, to manage it. And more importantly, it's about empowering the patients, because when you go to the doctor's office and the doctor says, hey, guess what, Mrs. Jones, you have lupus or whatever, you have rheumatoid arthritis, and you go, hey, doc, why do I have this? And the doctor's going to say, I don't know, bad luck, genetics. I mean, there's some weak answer.
That's what they told me about.
Right. You go, I don't know, maybe it's genetics. You're just unlucky, bad genetics. That's really unsatisfying. Then you say, what can I do about it? Well, you're going to have to take this drug the rest of your life. And then you're like, so now you're depressed because you're clueless. You don't know what's going on. You're depressed because, you know, you got medicine for the rest of it. Now you're dependent upon the doctor for the rest of your life just to write you prescriptions. And that's disempowering. So when you take that away and say, wait a minute, no, we know what, we think I have a good idea why you're sick. And this is what you can do. And we're going to help you. That's really empowering. And that's what I think medicine should be. It should be about, and you know, and our hope is, you know, once a week, I have a meeting with all our Rivero patients, you know, and we have a meeting and I say, you know what, guys, and we have good discussions. I like them. And I say, you know, but I hope I don't have to see you in a year. I hope you're gone, because we want you to be yeah, well and gone and not need it. Right. And I think that's how we got to go with healthcare. It's, you know, we spend, you know, they're $5 trillion a year on healthcare. We get crappy results and it's bankrupting the country. No one's getting better. Everybody's sick. You know, there's all these sick people that they're just medicated. That's not why I went into medicine. And so I'm much happier. I'm so much happier. I had fun being an orthopedic surgeon. It was cool going to the OR, cranking up the music, you know, fixing broken hips and flopping in, you know, new knees and stuff like that. But it pales in comparison to what I get to do today. It's so incredibly cool.
Yeah, and the beauty of it is if you're having success and folks are seeing results, the golden chain of referrals, it will probably be an endless amount of referrals. So you probably, you know, once people start having success and start referring their sick friends and family members to Rivero, you probably couldn't get people well fast enough.
Well, it's got to hire more docs, you know. Yeah, we got to hire more docs, and we're hiring more, and we fill up as soon as we get, you know. So, like I tell people, if you want to sign up, get going, you know. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that, and the other thing that's really cool is the physicians that work for us are super happy. I mean, you know, because you think about it, when you go to the doctor, like when I was an orthopedic surgeon, people were not happy to see me. No one wants to go to the surgeon because you got to get your knee replaced, your ankle, your broken ankle fixed. That's not a happy time. Now people, they want to see us. They're like, man, doc, we want to see you guys, because, you know, they used to, you dread going to the doctor. Like, oh, man, because you're sick, you know, you're broken. You got to get fixed. And now it's cool because everybody's on board. Like, hey, let's fix this. Let's fight together and get this done.
Yeah, and you know what's fascinating? It was Andy Scuvener mentioned the exact same thing with Crowd Health, that now doctors are reaching out to them because they're like, dude, we're going to get paid. Like, yeah, we'll give you a discount. Yeah, we'll give you 75% off because we're going to get paid up front as soon as you get the bill. We're not going to have to deal with all of this maze of paperwork and all this bureaucracy and all this, like, getting paid a third, like, net 120. Like, we can get our money now. Yeah, let's come to an agreement. And then, you know, so now docs are reaching out to Crowd Health, and it's very similar to now docs are reaching out to Rivero, because here's a system that's complementary, that is honestly helping people, and you go to work every day and you're helping people and they're having positive results, and it just becomes like a positive feedback loop.
Yeah, Andy's got a good model. Again, it's you got to qualify for their program, you know, because they kind of share revenue, share resources. And so, you know, that's a problem with, like, traditional insurance companies. If I'm super healthy and I don't really need much, I'm still subsidizing all these people that eat garbage and don't take care of them, and they drink and they smoke and they shoot up drugs and they crash their cars. You got to pay for all that stuff. And so it's distributed around the rest of the population. You're like, well, wait a minute, man. So, I mean, that's why it's, he doesn't, he can't call himself an insurance company. That's sort of the unique thing there that he do that. But yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of innovation. I mean, obviously we just swore a new president today, and I think the country's going to look in different directions about a lot of things. And I think healthcare is one of them. And I do think that, you know, companies similar to what we're doing are, you know, obviously biases to my own company, but I think we're going to see more and more of this people looking outside, you know, thinking outside the box and not just towing the pharmaceutical line. Because, you know, healthcare, I mean, as physicians, we've kind of just turned our brain off and let the pharmaceutical companies tell us what to do. I mean, literally, that's what happens. I mean, you get in there and you just, what's the next drug? What's the next innovation? You know, and then I just, you know, they teach me how to do it and I do it. And the physicians have lost all their power in healthcare. Physicians are very powerless at this point. It's been taken over by administrators. You know, most independent private practices have been bought up by big corporations. So you have all these, you know, Kaiser Permanente and Intermountain West and all these big giant, you know, giant, huge corporations. And it's all a business to them. You know, it's the business of medicine. The art of medicine is now the business of medicine. And, you know, if you're an independent-minded, critically thinking physician and you question any of it, good luck. You're going to get kicked out, fired, and won't have a job.
Yeah. And we're all, as individuals, we're very complicated and everybody has their own circumstances and everybody has their own immune system, and we're all created very individualistically. And even though something like a carnivore diet can be very comprehensive and beneficial, it's really important to have the resource of a doctor so that as you analyze your blood work, you know, it's just like with your financial plan and your financial position. If you don't know your numbers, you're toast, you know? And even though you're on this type of holistic metabolic diet like the carnivore diet, if you're not getting your blood work done and having somebody that knows what they're looking at, reading your numbers, if you're not keeping track of your numbers, you could be toast. Like, you could be hurting yourself. That's what's so neat to have a resource like Rivero for even just an average person that's not morbidly obese and doesn't have all these chronic ailments. If you had a qualified MD that can help you review your blood work and just make sure that all your numbers are good and you're on track and you don't need to tweak your diet. That's a powerful resource for people.
Yeah, I mean, we do certainly have those patients because, you know, you have people, and I want to be clear, Rivero is not just only carnivore diet. I mean, we'll use it when necessary, but I mean, a lot of it is just cleaning up, getting rid of the garbage out there. There's different, and we've analyzed lots of people with different conditions, and we looked at what foods and what lifestyle metrics seem to work best with typical conditions. And sometimes we'll have to continue to eliminate, and sometimes we end up on carnivore. But a lot of people come to us already on a carnivore diet, and they're like, you know, we're just tired of our doctor giving us a hard time. And they're really, they're like, okay, you got a doctor that's not going to tell me to go eat cardboard and take, you know, all these drugs to lower my cholesterol necessarily. And so, a lot of people do want to, they want an advocate rather than an adversary. You know, they want somebody to work with it. And we still have the criticism is most doctors are clueless when it comes to nutrition, which I think is a fair criticism. But some of them that have actually taken it up have been sort of brainwashed by like the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, which is basically a vegan propaganda arm. And so you get this sort of push that everybody needs to be on this low-fat, plant-based diet, and that's the holy grail. Well, many people have already tried that, and it's just something that, for whatever reason, either the advice is bad or it's not sustainable for most people, and they're like, I can't do it. It's, you know, I don't want to be hungry all the time, and that's a real issue. You know, you're sitting there like, I can't live my life when I'm hungry, you know, all the time. And that's just, you know, so then people, they do it for a little while, then they get hungry, then they go back to eating junk food. And then the doctor's the same way. I had a doctor tell me, oh, well, I couldn't do this diet because I couldn't fight my biological urge to eat cookies. And so therefore none of my patients can either. And I'm like, are you kidding me, dude? I mean, first of all, cookies, it's not biological urge to eat cookies. Cookies didn't even exist that long ago. It's like, God said, or, you know, whatever, let there be cookies or something like that. I don't know.
But it's the cookie monster.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's funny.
Yeah. So, I want you to help people. What about, we all know that we need fiber, Dr. Baker. What are you supposed to do? Like, you don't eat fiber.
I don't.
What about fiber?
I don't eat fiber. I've not had a bowel movement in over 8 years. Like, you know, I've got 7,000 pounds of crap. No, I mean, kidding. I mean, it's just, Yeah, I mean, it's here's the deal on fiber. Fiber, so if you look at the nutrition science, and nutrition science is not a very strong science. I mean, there's so much associative data. It's not really clear cut. You don't do actual experiments. So it's all guesswork. You know, it's kind of like most of it is like, we're going to hand out a survey to 20,000 people and ask them what they ate last year, right? And you can't remember that. I mean, I do because I eat the same stuff every day. But I mean, most people cannot remember what they ate. You know, you tell them, how many blueberries did you eat in 1997? I don't friggin' know. I'm going to guess. So this is what happened. So all that data, in fact, they just did a really nice study using doubly labeled water to track how much food people are eating versus what they said they eat. And they found out they're about 50% inaccurate. So they're about 50% wrong. So like 50% of the data on all these things is complete garbage. And yet they're making all these associative claims based on that. And so fiber is just one of those things where they said, well, you know, people that eat more fiber tend to have less heart disease, they have less cancer, they live longer, on and on and on. But I mean, fiber is a proxy for wealth in many ways. I mean, in Western countries, you know, people that eat organic fruits and vegetables and whole grains tend to have more money than people that they're eating cookies and potato chips. I mean, that's the reality. So therefore, fiber is associated with a better outcome. You know, fiber is said to, one of the thoughts is, well, why does fiber improve things? Well, it lowers like the glycemic excursion. Like if you eat an apple and you drink and you should take a shot of apple juice, right? The apple juice is going to make your blood glucose go up a lot higher than the apple will because the fiber is slowing that down. What if I don't eat a bunch of glucose? What if I don't eat a bunch of carbohydrates? Well, then that effect is nullified, right? You don't need that. So the other thing is they're saying that fiber can produce satiety, and that's kind of a tenuous claim. Like if I eat a bunch of fiber, it fills me up and I don't eat as much. Sometimes what it does is it gives you so much discomfort. Like, oh, I'm just bloated. I don't want to eat anymore. That's true. It sometimes does that, but I don't know if that's really a benefit. Fiber has been associated with things like, well, the big reason a lot of people talk about fiber is, oh, you need it to feed your gut. You know, if you don't feed the right microbes, everything, hell's going to break loose and your colon's going to, the mucus in your colon's going to fall away and these bacteria are going to eat your colon and So my colon has not been eaten yet, despite no fiber, believe it or not. But I mean, the reality is, like they say, well, one of the major benefits of fiber is, you know, when you ferment these carbohydrates in the gut or the fiber, you know, the cellulose that's in the gut, it produces something called a short-chain fatty acid. And these short-chain fatty acids are nutrition for some of the cells in the gut. Well, maybe not surprise you, but, you know, you don't need fiber to do that. You can get it from protein. You can get it from from blood ketones, which are in there. So, you know, butyric acid is a short-chain fatty acid that people talk about that feeds the gut. Well, butyric acid sounds a lot like beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is the same molecule with just a very minor difference. And those molecules go back and forth. They're reversible reactions, you know, in chemistry where you saw the reactions going back and forth. And they do that in the body. So if you're in a low-carb state, those same cells are getting nourished very nicely. I mean, they got a blood supply, so they can get the blood supply there. So it's not necessary. And in many cases, I mean, there's studies out there that show that it actually worsens things. There's a study on rheumatoid arthritis that shows that a higher fiber diet makes rheumatoid arthritis worse. There's a study Ann Perry did, a colonoscopy study, where they looked at 2,000 people. The ones that ate the highest fiber, had the most bowel movements, had the worst diverticular disease. It made their colon actually worse. There's studies on chronic constipation. No fiber cures it. High fiber makes it worse. I think there was another study on ulcerative colitis also making it worse. So there's, you know, the fiber is unnecessary. It's thought to be necessary by a guy named Dennis Burkett, who was a doctor back in the 1930s who traveled to, I think, Uganda. And he was in Africa looking around and said, oh, look, these people don't have diabetes, right? Well, it must be all the fiber they're eating. That's basically what he said. I was like, well, they're not sedentary. They don't eat a bunch of sugar. I mean, there's a lot of things you could have picked, but he picked fiber as his rationale. And so we've kind of stuck with it. And, you know, you've got all these companies that, you know, cereal, they put fiber in food as a filler because it's cheap, right? You put methyl cellulose in it, it's basically wood pulp. We got plenty of wood pulp. It's a cheap ingredient. Throw it in there, tell people they got to eat it. And, you know, it's because fiber is not digestible by human beings. It's indigestible, but it goes into our digestive system. And we've been bought into the sort of belief system that we need this indigestible stuff to be in our digestive system, so that the bugs that live there are happy. But guess what? you can cut your whole colon out, right? There's people that don't even have a colon. They effectively have essentially almost no microbiome, and they live just fine. They can live a long, healthy life without even a colon. So it's like, well, explain those people. Well, we can't really explain that. Anyway, there's a lot of holes in that theory. I mean, but the biggest thing is I've got thousands upon thousands of people that eat no fiber, and not only are they not sick, they're in the best health of their life. So it's like, well, how do you sort of square those two facts? You know, you need fiber, but if you don't eat it, you're in better health. So anyway, it's an interesting discussion.
Yeah. And what I was thinking, a cool way to kind of close out our conversation, I was recently watching a video by Dr. Peter Attia. And what was more interesting about this video is that he had actually published this video 2 years ago, and then they reissued the video where he's discussing what does science tell us about the carnivore diet. It's him and Stefan Gagné. Yeah, and I thought maybe we could watch the first 5 minutes of this and then we could respond to it, because I think this is what kind of like holds people back a lot. There's so much conflicting information. And there's a lot of dishonesty, and I thought this kind of like encapsulated that. So I thought we could. So the reason I wanted to kind of give that intro is because the first thing that I found very curious to me is, you know, Dr. Peter Attia, he is like a longevity specialist, right? And he was like, oh, hey, so I got this other doctor on, and I've never really looked into the carnivore diet, and I don't know anything about it, but let's discuss it. And I'm like, wow, that's kind of really weird, because the whole point of the discussion is the carnivore diet, but you open it up by saying, yeah, I haven't really looked into this or studied it, but let's discuss it, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I suspect he is probably maybe seen more than he leaves on. You know, I think he's trying to be sort of dismissive of it, saying, well, it's just something that's so beneath me, I'm not going to talk about it perhaps. But I think that, you know, as we talked about before, you know, saying, oh, we just get bored of eating and that's why it works. You know, I can tell you, man, I enjoy eating. I love eating. I eat all the time. I look forward to my meals. I happen to like steak. The more you do it, the more you like it. So you don't really get bored of eating. You get to where you don't crave garbage, which is nice. I mean, I think that's a real benefit there. But, you know, Stefan is correct in the things he listed as why it would be cause us to lose weight or not overeat. I think that's more important. It prevents us from wanting to overeat the garbage and be, which is what our modern food environment does. And so in some ways, you know, like I said, you can make the argument from several standpoints. Some people will make an argument of this is what the nutrition science says. And some people will say, well, nutrition science is a very broken science. It's not a very good science. We've got other scientific things we can look at. Some people will look at it from a perspective of biology or anthropology and say, hey, look, anthropology says, you know, we've got pretty good evidence that humans ate a lot of meat. And you can say, well, what's your natural diet? I mean, if we're debating the diet of zebras, we've got wild zebras we can go look at. We don't really have wild humans that much anymore. I mean, most of them that are there have been marginalized. Their food supply has been decimated. So you've got hogs that are running around, you know, chasing, eating baboons. That's not what they were eating 200 years ago. They were killing elephants and eating rhinoceroses and cape buffalo and that type of stuff. So, yeah, but I mean, this is where it's frustrating for me. It's like, why don't you ask me to chime in? I know this stuff. I literally spend my whole life every day talking to people on carnivore. I can speak intelligently. And you got people who are just kind of speaking off the cuff. I mean, I think, I I've heard so many criticisms on it, and it's basically, the criticisms are often there's not. Well, it used to be there were no studies on the carnivore diet, right? There's no studies. Now there are studies on the carnivore diet. And there's like, of course, now there's not enough studies. And so it'll never be. And, like if we look at, like for instance, a plant-based vegan diet. Vegan diet was first described back in the 1940s, right? You know, 80 years ago. So they've had 80 years to compile data and do friendly studies, and it's propagandize the literature to that point. And so you're like, oh, well, there's more studies on that. It must be healthier. Well, I can point to not just a handful, but many thousands of people who've done both. They've done a plant-based diet and they've done a carnivore diet. And almost without exception, they'll say, no comparison. Carnivore diet was miles and miles. It was worlds apart better than this plant-based thing. Plant-based thing wrecked me. I was sick. It's not to say that some people don't do okay on a more plant-based diet, but again, it's you know, what's your comparator? You know, if your comparator is the standard American junk food diet, yeah, just about anything will be an improvement on that. And so, yeah, but I mean, it's the reason Peter Attia re-released that video from 2 years ago is because carnivore has gotten more and more popular. It's not going away. People think that's a fad diet. It's going to fade away. Well, if that's true, good. I hope it does. My sort of observation is, because it works for so many people, it just works. Good things stick around. You know, it's got this sort of called Lindy effect where, you know, classic things that consistently work over time went out. The cream rises to the top, so to speak.
Yeah, and there is medical studies and data on a ketogenic diet and ketosis and all that stuff. And I think it's kind of disingenuous to disconnect a carnivore diet from a ketogenic diet because there's a substantial amount of data out there, and to disassociate the two, I think, is pretty dishonest.
Well, they certainly share a lot of the same physiology, for sure. And a lot of people are in ketosis on carnivore. Not everybody, but a lot of people are. I mean, you certainly can do it that way. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, there's a study out of Harvard 2021 that Ludwig did on 2,000 carnivores. There's a case series on inflammatory bowel disease. There's a case series on anorexia. There's a case series on mental health. There's case reports on autoimmune conditions. And there's more coming out. There's a case series coming out on multiple sclerosis, which is going to be published. There's another one on psoriasis, which we're in the middle of doing right now. There's going to be several intervention trials coming in the near future. So, I mean, we're putting more data. We're putting more studies in literature. And, you know, I mean, the people that don't want to accept it will criticize the studies. First, they criticize the lack of studies. Then they'll criticize the quality of the studies. And then they'll criticize, you know, this or that aspect of the studies or who funded this. I mean, it's never going to go away. People are ideologically attracted to whatever they believe. They bought into their scientific religion. Like people said, I can't remember who, maybe it was Heisenberg that said this, that science advances one death at a time. You know, you got to wait for these people to die off because they're never going to change their mind. So in the meantime, you know, you got to do what works for you as a person. When you're waiting around, if you're waiting around for the science to tell you what to do, you're going to be waiting a long time. So I say, you know, my mind is say, hey, try it out, see what happens. It works, it'll work if it doesn't. If it works, great. If it doesn't, go try something else.
Does Rivero have any plans as far as compiling data for?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we are. We have a whole research team. So as we collect data, we'll be publishing all that stuff. And so that's
awesome. One
of the exciting things. So yeah, we've already got our, you know, some of the early analysis on our earliest patients, and it's looking good. So yeah, we'll be releasing all that stuff. Yeah, for sure. Because that's at the end of the day. I mean, we have to show. I mean, not only are we showing. We want to show clinical outcomes, which I think is important, but we also show cost savings outcomes because that is
awesome.
A big part of it. You know, if right now we're direct to consumer. We will go enterprise, and so we'll be working with companies to try to get their employees healthy so they're not spending so much money on their healthcare costs. You know, it's kind of the same thing. So we're like, you know, we want to show that, you know, if this guy normally spends $20,000 a year on healthcare costs and we can cut it to $2,000. That's a huge difference, right? If the company's, particularly the company's footing the bill, if they're self-insured, they got to pay for all this crap. So it's like, yeah, if we can get this person off this rheumatoid arthritis drug that costs them, you know, $3,000 every month, you know, and now they don't got to take it anymore. It's like, that's a big win. So yeah, absolutely. We're publishing our, we'll.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay. So in closing, Dr. Baker, I'll link your YouTube channel down below, but where can people find more information on Dr. Baker?
Yeah. So again, obviously if you're looking for a physician that, you know, is going to do root cause stuff, is not going to just, you know, it's going to actually take care of you, go to Rivero.com. If you are, so my social media, Sean Baker MD, I guess, is my YouTube channel. I also got a Sean Baker Pie. It's like two YouTube channels. I do a bunch of interviews. I do interviews. I interview a lot of people that have had success. I mean, I just did another one this morning. So Sean Baker MD and then Sean Baker Podcast are my two YouTube channels. I've got a Twitter or now X, S Baker MD, Instagram, Sean Baker 1967. I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I also have a TikTok, Sean Baker MD. So, but I don't know how that one.
Well, I guess that got reinstated, huh? The TikTok.
Yeah, it did. I think Trump or somebody turned it back on. And then I'm also on Facebook at Sean Baker MD, I think. I think that's what I'm on Facebook. So I got, you know, just the main social media trying to get this message out to as many people as possible.
Yeah, love and appreciate the message. Appreciate the sarcasm and the satire. I think it's needed to kind of get past the propaganda and, you know, stir the pot a little bit, which I think is really cool. Sean, man, thanks for coming on. We appreciate you and hope to talk again soon.
All right, man. Thanks much. Appreciate it. Y'all have a good one.
All right.
Take care.
You too. Thanks.